Hello, my name's David Emery, and it is my privilege to be interviewing Dr. Michael Parenti, along with his colleague Peggy Noten, the author of a very important article from Covert Action Quarterly number 54. That article is entitled The Wonderful Life and Strange Death of Walter Reuther. Michael, welcome to our airwaves.
Hello, David. How are you?
Okay, good. Walter Reuther is a name very well known to people familiar with the labor history of the United States, a name very familiar to people familiar with the history of progressive politics in this country, but not a name that is probably known to a great many Americans in the year of our Lord, 1996. Michael, why don't you begin by explaining a little bit to us about who Walter Reuther was, what his significance was for American society, and why someone may have wanted him out of the way.
Well, he was probably one of the most progressive labor union leaders that the United States has ever produced. He also was a man of tremendous intelligence, resourcefulness, and incorruptible. And he helped build and became president of the largest union in the Western industrial world, and that was the United Auto Workers. And this went on through the 1930s and into the 40s and 50s. And right into, in fact, the 1960s, when he was killed in an auto crash. In a plane crash, a private plane of his.
As you pointed out, he not only was involved in building a very large and powerful labor union, obviously not something that's going to be pleasing to the powers that be, we'll get into that in a second, but he also used that power on behalf of a great many other causes, such as civil rights, anti-militarism, anti-imperialism. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the specifics of his activism outside of union?
Yeah, Reuther was hated by the auto bosses because of his labor militancy and his dedication to the workers. He wasn't a union leader who could be bought off. He was one who fought for their interests, and this was enough to hate him, and this got the Ford Motor Company thugs beat him up once, and there was an attempt on his life, and J. Edgar Hoover stalked him for the better part of 35 years or more. And tried to block appointments that he was going to be given to federal commissions and committees and things like that. But in addition to that, Walter Reuther also had a larger social agenda. Let me quote him. I got this in the article. It's very brief. He said, "The labor movement is about changing society. What good is a dollar an hour more in wages if your neighbor is if your neighborhood is burning down? What good is another week's vacation if the lake you used to go to where you've got a cottage is polluted and you can't swim in it and the kids can't play in it? What good is another $100 pension if the world goes up in atomic smoke?" So Reuther was that kind of labor leader who really discomforted the higher circles whose job it is to keep America safe for the Fortune 500 and keep the world safe for global capitalism. I mean, he was militant, and he had not only a dedication to the rank and file and union issues, but a broader class agenda. He fought for racial equality. He fought for environmental safety. He fought against militaristic interventions by the U.S. He fought against the nuclear arms race and was a critic of U.S. policy, a constant escalation of the military budget and nuclear arsenal. And he also condemned and came out against the Vietnam War. He was critical, and his brother Victor even more so, critical of the CIA and the CIA's role in using AFIELD, that is, using AFL front unions down in Latin America to set up these puppet CIA-financed unions, which would undermine the more militant and left unions that existed.
AFIELD, by the way, is an acronym for the American Institute of Free Labor Development, which is actually oxymoronic because it was exactly
the opposite.
Precisely. By the way, Philip Agee's the company, inside the company, a CIA diary goes into AFIELD at considerable length.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned that he was very active, in particular, against the Vietnam War, and that he threw the considerable power of his union behind the civil rights movement in the early 1960s.
Right. And then he also, because he had such differences with George Meany, when the United Auto Workers was part of the AFL-CIO, and Phil Green and these other people, these guys were all right-wingers and hard-liners on the Cold War, and they're the only ones that would get, you know, funneled up into positions of dominance. And, well, he, you know, because he had these differences, he broke with the AFL-CIO in the mid-60s, and he formed the ALA, the American Labor Alliance, with the Teamsters and a couple of the smaller unions, and they had, you know, they had a it was a good sized organization of I forget now membership. I've got it in the article there, but the point is that it gave him a freer hand. He really came out and started talking against U.S. interventionism and all that sort of thing.
When he died, we're going to get to the circumstances surrounding his death, both politically and forensically in a few minutes. Walter Reuther's life, along with that of his brother and colleague in UAW activities, Victor, had been not only threatened, but had been had suffered attacks on it almost throughout the course of his political and labor history. You mentioned in your article that after being fired from the Ford Motor Company for union activities, he spent 3 years touring the world, including working at an automobile plant in the Soviet Union. And he wrote a letter home encouraging people to say to carry on the fight, which the FBI then deliberately forged into saying carry on the fight for a Soviet America. And as you point out,
right, it was his brother Victor who wrote the letter, and his brother signed it. You know, Wall and Vic, and or Vic and Wall. And so that letter was then circulated by Hoover. Even though they had the original copy, the doctored version was circulated to members of Congress, to presidents of the United States whenever they thought of wanting to appoint Reuther to some kind of blue ribbon commission, you know, to do something or look at something. And in every case, Hoover was able to block appointments for Walter Reuther.
The course of his activities as a UAW organizer was interrupted by a number of violent incidents, two of them at least, and possibly more, involving people from the so-called Ford Personnel Service. You discussed that in May 1937, he and some UAW colleagues were badly beaten up by some of those thugs. And then in 1938, a couple of the goons forced their way into his home, tried to abduct him, and it turned out that they had been working for a fellow named Harry Bennett, who was Ford's security chief. And yet, neither law enforcement nor the jury in the case of the attempted abduction would do anything about it.
That's correct. There was very lackadaisical prosecution of the thugs, and so nothing was done about it. And Harry Bennett, as I said, I think, was a buddy, a golfing buddy of J. Edgar Hoover. Harry Bennett was a thug. He used to take hardened criminals out of jails and put them to work as Ford security thugs.
By the way,
their job was to beat up union organizers, including beating up Walter Reuther, as you mentioned. And Bennett also fed J. Edgar Hoover dossiers on union organizers and labor people, mostly, you know, about their leftish or communist affiliations. So there was this whole kind of, you know, iron triangle between the criminal element, the corporate bosses, and the national security state, all of them working together to stop a progressive leader.
In that context, we should perhaps remember that Henry Ford, for whom Harry Bennett worked, was one of Adolf Hitler's earliest and most prominent financial backers. As George Seldes points out in his landmark work, Harry Bennett was able to employ these criminals for the Ford Personnel Service because he was the head of the Michigan State Parole Board, and he would then parole out many of the nastiest criminals in the state of Michigan who would ply their trade on behalf of the Ford Personnel Service.
Right. I didn't have that in the article, and I wasn't even aware of it. Maybe I did know that, but I know that's very interesting. I knew he had pull. I thought he had links with people in the parole board, but that may be so. And his word was to these prisoners, you do what I tell you, or you go back to prison.
Yeah, I'd have to check.
This was a kind of almost a blackmail thuggery there. You blackmail people into the service of violence and reactionism.
Yeah, in Facts and Fascism, that's the Seldes work that discusses that. I'd have to go back and check, but I'm pretty sure he was head of it. Maybe he was just on the parole board. But
yeah.
That's how he was able to get these people to work for him. You mentioned that that after the attempted abduction, Walter Reuther was shotgunned and badly wounded, and yet still the police did nothing about it.
About 10 years later, right, he was shot and while sitting in his home, through the window, bullet came. Left his arm, never recovered the full use of an arm and a hand, and not long after, the next year, and Victor Reuther believes to this day it was a message for Walter, but Victor was shot too, and he was shot in the head, and a bullet came in, took off a piece of his jaw, and took out one of his eyes, and Victor's still alive today, still works. But he had lived all his life with this terrible wound, and then the Senate, in an unprecedented move, because it was such an outcry at the time, passed a resolution asking or directing the Justice Department to investigate these two murder attempts, and Hoover refused to move on them. He just wouldn't do it. He said no federal law has been violated. In fact, there are a whole host of federal laws, the fugitive law, possible kidnapping, possible crossing of state lines, whatever, that's a conspiracy. But he just didn't. And, of course, how would he know no federal law has been violated if he didn't even initiate an investigation? So you had that kind of a thing going on. The UAW did its own investigation and got all sorts of leads and directed them right back to Harry Bennett, right back to mob, and right back to maybe some law people, too. And these leads were sat on by the FBI. The FBI went and looked at false leads or took them and just simply did what they could to sabotage or stonewall the investigation that UAW investigated. One UAW investigator on the case met a very suspicious and mysterious death when he was out fishing. He'd come up with a lot of stuff.
This was a fellow named Ralph Winstead.
Right.
Was he the witness who had provided the police with some eyewitness identification of the suspects in the shooting of Victor?
No. That witness was just a neighbor of Victor's who... the shooting of Victor was very suspicious. Are you going to be reading the article, did you say?
Yes, I will read this.
So I won't go into too many details. People will get it, but the shooting was very suspicious. And a neighbor gave a description, and the police told him to shut up. He got anonymous calls telling him to shut up, and he was so intimidated and all, he finally moved to Florida or something like that.
Yeah, by the way, the article will not be read on the other stations that carry this interview. I am going to read it on my home base station.
I see.
But we should note that this particular incident against Victor involved the apparent removal of his dog, which was a watchdog.
Right, and that involved police collaboration. The police came repeatedly and told Victor that his dog was disturbing the neighbors. Victor asked, what neighbors? I'd be happy to talk to them. I saw it. And in fact, the dog had barked a few nights rather briefly, and the dog rarely barked, and each time Victor went down to investigate, and there was a car parked in front of the house, and then it sped away. And finally, they said, you do something about that dog. They got amazingly insistent about it, and Victor reluctantly gave the dog away, and the very next night is when he was shot. He also had canvassed all the neighbors around, and not one of them complained and said, no, we never even heard the dog now. And and then, as I say, one of the neighbors who did give a description of the assailants was intimidated into silence and actually left the area.
We might note that J. Edgar Hoover, in refusing to follow up on the attacks on Walter Reuther, defied the wishes and orders of the United States Attorney General at the time, Tom Clark, the father of Ramsey Clark, who later followed him into the office of Attorney General.
Correct.
We should perhaps note, too, here, as we analyze Walter Reuther and what he did and why he had run afoul of the powers that be, he had also been requisitioned along with Joseph Rau, an attorney for UAW. Am I pronouncing that right, R-A-U-H?
Yeah, I think he pronounced it Joe Rau.
To investigate radical right-wing activities on the part of the Kennedy administration.
Yeah, on behalf of the Kennedy administration.
Right.
And they... Victor Walter and Joe Rau did say that there was right-wing activity in the U.S. military and that there were these hate groups and that these should be somehow stopped. Victor also, you know, played a role in the purging of the AFL, of the CIO, of left communist organized unions, unfortunately. I mean, Walter did. And that's unfortunate. Walter was red-baited mercilessly throughout his career, and he thought that by red-baiting in return, by dumping on the communists, that this would somehow establish his credibility. It never did that, it did very little to that effect. All it did was weaken the CIO and the AFL-CIO, and it was just the CIO at that time. And deprive them of millions of union members and cut out the more militant and some of the best organized and most honestly run unions were just kicked out because of the red baiting. Unfortunately, Walter fell prey to that sort of thing, which to this day is still done on the left by many people who have to show a bitter, ferocious anti-communism, anti-Sovietism, anti-existing communism, whatever, to supposedly retain their credibility, not realizing that the people on the right hate you whether you're a communist or a progressive or a socialist or an anti-communist leftist or an anti-communist trade unionist. They'll still hate you because you make moves against their interests. They use the communism to bait and get popular hysteria mobilized. But communism is not the issue. It's the question of class interests.
Exactly, exactly. I personally do not hold a brief for, quote, because communism is really a non-existent term, not even Marx. That was supposed to be the last stage of things. I never held a brief, for example, for the Soviet Union or the other socialist states. At the same time, they were never the demons we were told they were, and I can vouch that not supporting that kind of system gains you no ground at all in this country, politically speaking. You'll still get defecated on, both by the left wing and by the right.
And not just the Soviets or anything like that, but it's just the Communist Party USA. The need to disassociate and distance yourself from the Communist Party USA. And what the CPUSA was doing at that time in the 30s was leading the organizing of industrial unionism, leading the fight against racism and Jim Crow segregation in the South and calling for peace and all that sort of thing. And also organizing popular fronts against fascism. So, in fact, the things the communists were doing were pretty good things. I'm reminded of what Dick Gregory once said, is why don't we ever blame something bad on the communists? You know, when I hear about civil rights, I say, oh, the communists behind that. Or I hear about peace and disarmament, oh, the communists are behind that. Or the environment, oh, the communists are behind that. Why don't we blame something bad on them? And yet there was so much of this kind of anti-communism that even people of the caliber of Walter Reuther had to get in and join in on it, felt obliged to do that, and show he was as firm and loyal and anti-communist as anybody else.
One of the things about...
That's playing into the hands of the J. Edgar Hoovers and helping to create that very same atmosphere of witch hunting that gave Hoover his power over the American public.
Sure. One of the things that Walter Reuther had in common with two black American leaders, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, is that in the period of time leading up to all of their deaths, different periods of time in each of their cases, the agendas of each of those men had been broadened from their relatively narrow field of specialization in Ruther's case, labor activities. Obviously, in the case of both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, black civil rights, they had been broadening their agendas to an international agenda and to seeing their respective struggles as joined with and part of a global struggle for social justice and equality.
Correct. And a global struggle against certain common enemies. And it was that coalescence that I believe led to the death of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Walter Ruther. Ruther is maybe less known, but he, in a way, he was one of the more powerful and influential Republican leaders. Said somebody like Barry Goldwater, for instance, said that Ruther was more dangerous than Soviet divisions, you know. I mean, it was all this kind of hysterical kind of stuff. Walter Ruther was a greater menace than Soviet Russia might be, but I don't think Soviet Russia was that great a menace, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Other members of Congress said he was dreaming of establishing a socialist labor government in the U.S. And Ruther, by the way, did have a whole agenda on nutrition, on federally funded affordable housing, national health care, government ownership of monopoly industries, worker participation and economic planning. He had various proposals for redistributing power and wealth, all of which were taken as threats to the ruling class, and they certainly were. They certainly were very real threats. And I think that's why in May of 1970, the day after he sent a telegram to the White House, and shortly after he had ran a full-page ad in the major newspapers how the U.S. should get out of the Vietnam War and against U.S. interventionism in all these places, on May 1970, a rented private plane that he had rented to go off with two other leaders and his wife and the two pilots all were killed, and evidence shows that the altimeter of the plane, which records the altitude the plane is flying at, the altimeter had been tampered with in about seven serious ways, and all sorts of things that were wrong in it: the rocking shaft, an end stone, particular bolts, whatever, a link pin. All these things were either the wrong size or installed backwards or were put in incorrectly or had been loosened by deliberate human effort. And the investigation showed that the malfunctioning of the altimeter was the cause of the crash. The two pilots were perfectly experienced. They had flown into this airport before many times under worse weather conditions, and had a lot of miles, and they were in perfect condition, and they were well rested before the trip. The other thing was that a runway was incorrectly lit. The only lighted approach lacked a visual approach path, which would allow the plane to come in. And the main runway had a visual approach, but one of the runway lights had been knocked out at the last minute, so the pilots went off to the side runway. And they came down, and they were probably about 200 feet off because of the way this altimeter had been tampered with. So there's very, very real evidence. And the National Safety Transportation Board, which looked into this whole issue, National Transportation Safety Board, found this tampering and then ignored it on its own findings and came to no conclusion as to what happened. They just said it was a malfunctioning of the altimeter, and they never said what caused the altimeter to malfunction. Why would this altimeter have all these defects? The chances of all that happening were hard to believe.
In fact, you point out that there was a screw which was loose. There were we should recap perhaps for the listeners. There were a total of seven different defects with the altimeter, which would have read high by 200 to 250 feet, according to the investigators.
Right.
And a screw had come loose, and it was tested to see if perhaps the heat of the fire or the violence of the crash could have jolted it loose, and in fact, that was not the case.
Right, that's true. And I should also point out something else that was very strange. That is, just the year before, Walter and Victor had been in a rather similar crash going into Dulles in a small private plane. At that time, though, the weather was clear enough that at the last minute the pilots were able to elevate it and miss the whatever and land safely. But it was a crash landing, and everybody was banged up and hurt, but nobody seriously.
And that was that, too. That crash also, it was a crash landing with no casualties, but that was also caused by a defective altimeter. However, you point out that the pilots had noticed this because they had adequate visual means of assessing their height, so they were able to adjust for it.
Right, as I just said. And again, but isn't this odd that the same kind of accident with the same kind of malfunctioning altimeter would happen? It should also be pointed out that these private planes are rented out, and they have different pilots, maybe two or three or four in one day on the various trips. And for that reason, because it is a rented plane, the pilots demand that the planes be inspected very closely. They're inspected very closely, much more so than ordinary commercial airliners. And so what were the odds of that altimeter being functioning so poorly and going undetected? I believe it was tampered with just before the trip on which Walter and his wife went on their fatal voyage.
You pointed out that Glenn Campbell, the famous singer, had taken that same plane on a flight earlier that day with no incident.
Correct. And it landed, not just the same day, but the very flight just before Reuther's.
Again, for the audience, there were seven different defects with the altimeter when the plane crashed with Walter Reuther.
Yes, and Victor Reuther, to this day, and Elizabeth Reuther, Walter's daughter, and most of the family now are convinced that the crash was not an accident, it was sabotage. But the New York Times leaped forward with an article saying that no evidence of sabotage, the altimeter was malfunctioning. And that's not true. The report doesn't say anything one way or the other whether there was or wasn't sabotage. And if you read the actual report, there's quite a bit of evidence of sabotage, even just a reading of the report. I mean, Peggy Noten and I did some original research. We went through a lot of FBI documents. That proved almost useless, by the way. All the documents, FBI documents, relating to Walter Reuther's death were so heavily redacted that there was nothing to read on them except the little heading up at top, Reuther death, you know, and date or something, and one or two other little half lines in it.
Raising the question, of course.
So the question is, you know, since here it is 26 years after his death, and the FBI still is, what are they hiding in their documents about Walter Reuther's death? We don't understand. So we couldn't really get much investigation in those documents. But just reading the National Transportation Safety Board's report and the stuff in there is mind-boggling as to what really happened. So we believe that Walter Reuther was murdered, and he was murdered by very powerful people and interests, the same people who were killing, I believe, the same people who were killing a lot of other people.
They may not be directly,
but they don't directly necessarily do the job themselves. There's a whole plausible denial. There's a whole use of surrogate forces. You know, the CIA and FBI used the black Muslims to knock off Malcolm X, and they had two alpha teams ready to hit Martin Luther King, and instead they made sure a racist did it. You know, so they can get other people who were instigated and financed and given reassurances that they'll be thoroughly covered. But something is going wrong here when there's no investigation, when there's a history of suspicious actions, and when the person has these kinds of powerful enemies.
We might want to note, too, that the fatal crash, the previous altimeter defect was in October of 68. Walter Reuther was killed on May 9th, 1970. The day after, he sent a telegram to the White House condemning the killings at Kent State, where students were protesting Richard Nixon's invasion of Cambodia. That got Walter Reuther put right at the top of Richard Nixon's enemies list. Michael, we are all out of time. And once again, I want to thank you and your colleague Peggy Noten for this wonderful piece of investigative reporting. Again, the title of the article, for those who would like to hunt this down, This Wonderful Life and Strange Death of Walter Reuther, co-authored by Michael Parenti and Peggy Noten,
right.
published in Covert Action Quarterly number 54 from the fall of 1995.
Right. Thank you. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye, David.
Bye-bye now.